Welcome to the Sydney Hems podcast. This is the third in a series of podcasts aimed at new members of the Sydney Hems retrieval team. But of course, anybody is welcome to listen in. This is Cliff Reed. We're going to cover some aspects of inter-hospital retrieval in this episode, and I'm going to give an overview of our approach to the assessment of a critical care patient that we're going to move from one site to another. Now, we may be moving them because the referring site doesn't have the intensive care facilities to continue their critical care management, or because they require a procedure such as neurosurgery or interventional cardiology. In any case, I want us to imagine this patient is reasonably stable. There's nothing really urgent. They have septic shock. It's an adult who's intubated and ventilated, is on sedative and vasoactive infusions, and is going to be transferred to a larger ICU for management of their ongoing septic shock. Now, a heap of useful information can be gained from the initial phone call, so we usually arrive with some knowledge of the patient's status and their current therapy, but it's still necessary to do a top-to-toe assessment. That's what this podcast is about, and here's how I go about it. So on arrival, we introduce ourselves and we get a handover. And at the same time, we do a quick end-of-the-bedogram, a quick visual assessment to see if there are any urgent issues that have to be dealt with, like severe hypoxemia or a failure to ventilate or profound hypotension. After the handover, we then glove up and approach the patient. I grab a pen and notebook from my pocket and I note a few things down. I look at the ventilator settings and I look at the initial observations on the monitor. From the monitor, I want to get the ECG rate and rhythm. I want the blood pressure. I want the oxygen saturation. And if it's there, the end tidal CO2. On the ventilator, I'll note the mode of ventilation, the fractional inspired oxygen concentration, the PEEP, the respiratory rate, and the tidal volume. And I want to note whether the patient's taking any spontaneous breaths of their own. So what's the preset ventilatory rate and what's the overall rate that the patient's breathing at? I like to note down the actual minute volume and relate that to the patient's end tidal CO2. And this for me is a rough guide to the amount of ventilation I'm going to have to provide during retrieval. Now it's time to get hands on. We're going to start with A. I'm going to do an A, B, C, D assessment. With A, what size is the tracheal tube in terms of internal diameter? How far is it in? What's the cuff pressure? Is it in the center of the mouth or at the side of the mouth? This is important. A measurement taken with the tube going through the center of the mouth is different from that same measurement taken at the corner of the mouth. To put another way, if a patient has an ET tube going in at 22 centimeters in the center of the mouth, and later on you find that it's still at 22 centimeters, but at the corner of the mouth, the tip of that tracheal tube has migrated further down the trachea. This can be the difference between an endotracheal intubation and an endobronchial intubation. So to summarize that, the tube going down the corner of the mouth takes a shorter route into the airway and therefore is sticking further down if it's got the same length measurement compared with a tube to the same depth through the center of the mouth. So just eyeball, is it the corner or the center? Because if that moves during retrieval, the tip of the tube has moved. And of course, relate this depth of insertion to the position that it's at on the chest x-ray, and just question the staff as to whether that tube has been repositioned since the x-ray was taken. And as part of my A assessment, I check that the tracheal or airway positioning of that tube has been confirmed with end tidal CO2. On to B. How's this patient breathing? Are they synchronized well with the ventilator, or do we need to adjust ventilation settings or adjust sedation and analgesia, and if necessary, muscle relaxation? I look at the symmetry of the chest rise and listen to breath sounds, which for practical reasons is mainly anterior, although you can place your stethoscope end in the palm of your cupped hand and feed it under the posterolateral chest wall to auscultate part of the lung bases. Sometimes you have to assist this with a slight roll of the patient using your other hand. On to C, circulation. How is this patient's color, capillary refill, and skin temperature, both peripherally and centrally? Are the neck veins distended? Listen to the heart sounds. Feel the pulse. Is the pulse in keeping with the arterial line trace? Do you trust the numbers on the A line? Where is the transducer for the A line, which should be at the level of the heart? Does the mean arterial pressure from the art line resemble the mean arterial pressure from the non-invasive measurement? Because it should. And D, CNS. Let's do a neurological assessment by checking both pupils for size and reactivity. Assess the conscious level and note whether the patient has recently had any muscle relaxants. If they're moving their limbs, check for limb symmetry. And on to E. This is an opportunity to examine the rest of the patient, essentially the abdomen and the limbs. And under E, I ask for the most recent temperature and glucose. And this is where I note the lines and the tubes. What do they have for vascular access? How many peripheral lines do they have, and where are they? How big are they? Do they have a central line? Do they have an arterial line? Do they have a nasogastric tube, a bladder catheter, any chest tubes, any surgical drains? And I note the infusions and drips. Here's where we can disconnect any feed and any maintenance fluid. Most infusions of insulin and heparin can be discontinued for the duration of the transport. Restricting infusions to sedatives, analgesia, and vasoactives is the most common approach that we use. But we do also connect up a bag of crystalloid like Hartmann's or saline to a pump set or blood-giving set and connect that to a reasonably large, reliable line. This is for emergency fluid resuscitation and emergency drug access, and we make sure that line is accessible when the patient's packaged and usually labeled with a colored sticker. Urine bags and nasogastric drainage bags should be emptied. So once clinical assessment's complete, drips have been rationalized, we're now able to move the patient over to our equipment. The way I think about this, and this applies both pre-hospital and in-hospital, is that sick patients generally have three types of things coming off them, attached to other things. They have stuff going to their airway, might be a simple oxygen mask, or might be ventilator tubing going to their tracheal tube. That's the first one. The second one is they have monitoring cables, ECG, saturations, blood pressure. That's the second one. The third one is there's IV stuff, IV fluids and drug infusions. So these three things need to be taken care of. When you're transferring from one set of equipment to another, they need to move all these three things over. Think about the last podcast when we spoke about a patient trapped in a vehicle and we're extricating them. When we're moving them out onto the spine board, those are the three things I watch. The oxygen, the monitoring cabling, and the IV access and the drip fluid. Some of these things can be disconnected for a brief period of time during extrication, but some of us prefer to leave them on. But somebody needs to look after each of those three things. The airway and oxygen, the monitoring cable, and the IV stuff. Okay, back to our inter-hospital transfer patient then. How are we going to move our patient over to our infusions, our monitoring, and our ventilator? Well, there are actually two schools of thought within our own service on here. Some of the teams prefer to move the patient over to our stretcher first while still remaining connected to the referring hospital's monitoring and drug infusion equipment, and then change over to our equipment. The other camp likes to put them on our monitors and our infusions first, and then move them over to our retrieval stretcher. If you can make it work, it probably doesn't matter. I'll express my clear preference, which is while the patient's still on the referring hospital bed, I like to switch the monitoring cables over to our monitoring, and the drug infusions over to our infusion pumps. Two reasons for that. One is we know all our stuff is working before we've done the physical move of the patient. The second thing is there just seems to be less entanglement. Often the referring hospital's ECG leads may be going around the back of the patient, or the oximetry cable may be a bit tied up inside the patient's gown. These things can become an embuggerance if you then move the patient over to our stretcher, and they become even more tangled up in the local equipment. Whereas if we change over to our equipment, there's nothing connecting that patient to the referring hospital's bed or monitor or drip stands. It's all between the patient and our stretcher bridge. So we can keep an eye on those cables, we can keep them clear of snags, and when we move the patient over to our stretcher, they're ready to go. They're almost completely ready to move. Our infusion pumps are connected and running, our monitoring cables are on, and we have everything lighting up on the screen. The only remaining thing to do then is to change over from the referring hospital's ventilator to our ventilator. And we're pretty much all in agreement that that's the last thing we do, because we run our ventilator on a portable oxygen cylinder, and we want to preserve that supply and not use it until we really have to. The exception to that is in the difficult to oxygenate or difficult to ventilate patient, where we may wish to run them on our ventilator for a period of time to ensure that we can adequately ventilate them. This obviously involves connecting our ventilator to the wall supply of oxygen and doing it that way. At some point during this process, I want an up-to-date blood gas from this patient's arterial line so I can correlate the PCO2 with the end-tidal CO2. This is particularly important in neurological or neurosurgical emergencies where we really want a tight range of PCO2 to aim for. So we'll correlate the PCO2 with the end-tidal CO2 on our monitor so we know exactly what we're achieving in terms of our own ventilation. The remaining things to get ready are the patient's notes, any radiology reports, a bunch of stickers to put on our own documentation, and making sure we have enough infusions to replace existing infusions if they run out en route, and any bolus drugs that we may need to give. For example, if we elect not to muscle relax the patient, it might still be helpful to have a syringe of rocuronium should there be issues en route, such as ventilatory difficulties that might require muscle relaxation. Make sure we haven't left any of our own equipment or clothes behind, such as our ambulance jacket, and we get going. Now, most retrieval specialists will vary in the order in which these things are done, and some flexibility and opportunism are required when clinical urgency dictates. However, we'd probably all agree that you need a system with structure that helps you avoid missing key information. So I like the ABCDE approach, which I recommend to you. So let's just summarize. We know a bit about the patient before we get there from the initial phone call. When we arrive, we say hello, we get a handover, we do our end of the bedogram. We get our gloves on and get hands on the patient nice and early. The first thing I do is take out my notebook and pen and write down the ventilator settings and the observations on the monitor. I then look at the tracheal tube, the ventilation, the cardiovascular status, and the neurological assessment. As part of my e-assessment, I check the abdomen, the limbs, all the lines, drips, infusions, and then we make sure that blood glucose and temperature have been checked. We stop any feed and maintenance fluids, and we connect up some IV crystalloid on a pump set or blood-giving set for emergency use. We then transfer the patient to the retrieval monitoring and retrieval infusion pumps, and then coordinate their transfer over to the retrieval stretcher while still on the hospital ventilator. The last thing we do is connect to our ventilator and our end-tidal CO2. We need to correlate a blood gas PCO2 with the end-tidal CO2 so we can appropriately target our ventilation. We make sure we have the patient's notes, radiology results, stickers, and enough replacement infusions and other emergency drugs before we go. That's it. Come back soon for another podcast. Thanks for listening.